You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Thursday, October 1st, 2020. I'm Matt Leck on a Matt, Brendan, Jamie, and Matt Binder Thursday on the five-time award-winning Majority Report, broadcasting closer than ever to the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, ANC apartheid revolutionary, anti-apartheid revolutionary, I want to stress, Ronnie Kasrils and Michael Brooks, another throwback interview on how to resist Trump from an ANC perspective and what the ANC struggle actually looked like. Also on the program, another 837,000 Americans filed new unemployment claims last week as American Airlines and United announced they're cutting 32,000 jobs. This is a V-shaped recovery. It's more of a aggressive cursive V. DHS documents obtained by NBC News shows Trump officials encouraging law enforcement officials to speak positively about teen vigilante killer Kyle Rittenhouse. Law and order, folks. The People of Praise, the bizarre religious group tied to Trump's SCOTUS pick Amy Coney Barrett, has been scrubbing all references of her from their website. Pope Francis snubs Mike Pompeo now that it's clear that he's simply operating as an international wing of the Trump 2020 campaign.
Or anti-Catholic hate.
Yeah, anti-Catholic. Pompeo's anti-Catholic because of Coney Barrett. Or Pope Francis's. The Commission on Presidential Debates is considering changes after Tuesday's debacle that would offer structure to the next one. Structure, I think, is another word for a mute button. And major pharmaceutical companies raise drug prices exponentially by hundreds of thousands of percent to boost profits and executives' bonuses, a House panel said Wednesday in what's known as good campaign season oversight. Speaking of pharma, the Moderna CEO, Stéphane Bancel, said Wednesday that his company's coronavirus vaccine won't be ready for widespread public distribution until spring of next year. All that and more on today's Majority Report. I believe this is the second Ronnie Kasrils interview we're playing for the Michael throwback, but I think Michael would find that appropriate. He was one of his favorite people to interview. You can check out the other one. I went into Ronnie's bio a little bit more in that one. But this one came a few months after Trump's inauguration, and I think it was – you know, you see the limitations of the parties a little bit and how the Democrats could lose to a person like Trump. And I think this Ronnie Kasrils interview is good for remembering that, like, a revolutionary mindset isn't just understanding that electoral democracy isn't going to save us. There's a bit more to it than that. It wasn't Mandela wasn't arrested for, you know, pointing out the limitations of the liberal parties. Over and over again, it was organizing to basically compensate for those limitations. So I want to play this. This is about a half-hour interview with Ronnie. And once we get done with that, we'll return with Jamie and Matt Binder, and we'll do the fun half. So, folks, we will see you on the other side.
Welcome back to the Majority Report. I'm Michael Brooks. I'm sorry about that technical difficulty. Joining us now is Ronnie Kasrils. He is a legendary South African freedom fighter. He served as a deputy defense minister under Nelson Mandela, minister of intelligence under Thabo Mbeki, and water minister under Thabo Mbeki as well. Ronnie, are you there?
I am. Good evening from South Africa.
Good afternoon from Brooklyn, New York. It's great to be talking with you again. Thank you so much for joining us. Before we get to the bigger sort of terrain that we get to, that we'll get to in South Africa and hopefully also in the United States, Ronnie, can you tell everybody just briefly how you came to be who you are? What got you into politics? What radicalized your politics and your journey to a certain extent?
Okay, well, here goes with a revelation about how ancient I am. I grew up in Johannesburg, a part called Yeovil, which I think with a lot of Jewish immigrants was a bit like part of New York I've heard about and been to. My father was a factory worker, salesman kind of thing, and grew up in Johannesburg in the war years. I was affected by the war against fascism. There was anti-Semitism to some degree in South Africa, but what was happening in Nazi Germany and Europe affected me as I grew up. So I found that as a youngster, I was very empathetic to the suffering of black people that was so visible even to a young kid. And I had parents who encouraged me to be that way, a very sweet mother, not a political family as such, but who kept talking about doing unto others what you would want them to do unto you. Anyway, to come to my early adult life, I was a scriptwriter for a film company near the famous African township of Alexander Township in the north of Johannesburg, and was beginning to interact across the color bar line when the Sharpeville massacre took place.
Can you explain that, that briefly for our listeners?
That's March 1960, peaceful demonstration of African people, of the black people, who had to carry special identity papers. If they didn't have them on them, they just disappeared into the jails. It was very unpopular. It was a way of controlling African labor, African movement in and out of the cities and so on. And this led to this infamous massacre, 69 people shot down, 250 dreadfully wounded. And I then decided that if I was to make something of my life, I actually needed to take a stand in the country I lived in on that issue. I would say a bit like the American civil rights movement and the young whites who were drawn into it, and some who got murdered, as we know. Deep south of the United States, there were aspects there that were similar to South Africa. I'm not saying I was that up to date with it then, but we were actually quite aware of what was taking place in America, I must say, with Martin Luther King Jr. and so on. It had actually impressed us to a degree when I had joined of doing some of the things that were taking place in America, breaking some of the apartheid laws of not being able to sit with black people in public and, you know, those dreadful segregation aspects. But I very quickly became involved with the ANC, with the South African Communist Party, and with the ANC's armed wing, Umkhonto weSizwe, which is something I became very involved in for a very long period of my time, both in South Africa in terms of a sabotage campaign led by Mandela to announce the new method of struggle, basically because the ANC had come to see that the peaceful forms of struggle which it had been wedded to were no longer optimal, that you couldn't make change in South Africa with nonviolence alone. But it wasn't terrorism. It was it was very much focused in terms of the masses and getting mass struggle reignited after the bannings of the ANC, PAC, and Communist Party. But to cut a long story short, I managed to evade the authorities in that period. A lot of the comrades I was with went to prison for a very long period. Some died in detention. And I basically found myself for something like 27 years in exile, working for the ANC in the neighboring territories in Angola and Mozambique, and going for further military training, directing operations until we could come back into the country in 1990 when the regime decided and agreed to negotiate with Mandela's ANC. I then became, as you've reported, a minister serving in both his government and Thabo Mbeki's until I resigned when the ANC unceremoniously recalled Mbeki from presidency in a virtual putsch, I would say, in 2008. And from then on, I've tended to operate outside of the structures of the ANC, raising my voice with civil society, with the trade unions, against corruption, against the descent into crony capitalism, and all the sins that we've seen taking place in South Africa under Jacob Zuma since.
So,
in a nutshell,
that's,
and I'm breathless as a result.
And no one would hold it against you. You know, many people have retired after accomplishing far less. But what is interesting to me, I mean, first I want to ask you just one brief historical question, because this has been something that I've actually been writing and thinking about a lot. And then we'll get to the present with Jacob Zuma. But there was an official, and in some ways, it's certainly from a kind of global perspective, I don't think it's, you know, many people are aware of this, that there actually was a kind of official opposition to apartheid. There was a Progressive Federal Party. There was a party that acted in South African Parliament during apartheid. They accepted that it could be a whites-only party. They accepted the sort of governing frameworks, but they sort of posed a somewhat liberal alternative to apartheid. And I'm just curious as to what made you kind of skip that route and go directly to this kind of broader sense of confrontation. And I ask that not because, you know, the situation we're in the United States is radically different, but in some ways we have, you know, an official opposition party that misses so much of the structural problems that led to the dissent we're in. And I think people are looking for kind of broader outlets and venues. It's very different, but there are some parallels. And I'm just curious what sort of got you to that radicalism directly in terms of really going to the kind of root of the problem in apartheid South Africa?
Yes, thanks. I followed what you've said, and I can see where you're going with it. And I've got a lot of friends in the States, and a couple of months ago, I was at a wedding in Jamaica, which drew a lot of Americans, including Amy Goodman, your Amy.
Yeah.
So I know how people are responding to what's occurred since Obama. In terms of South Africa, it's not quite like what you've had.
Right.
But there are certain parallels. So we're talking about a very young Ronnie Casrolls who couldn't have really been, say, around or close to the mainstream politics of South Africa, as of course many good people in the States have been close to the Democratic Party in your two-party system. But one's consciousness in South Africa under very extreme conditions, which I guess is what you're facing in the States now, your thought processes, your actions, your consciousness does speed up. So I came from a family, I said they weren't very political, but they did like a lot of the English-speaking South Africans, which amongst the whites then and now is about 40%, the other 60 being Afrikaans speakers with a background from Germany and the Netherlands and so on, way back, centuries back. So the kind of English opposition, which had been the ruling party for much of the first part of the 20th century, up to the time the National Party of the Afrikaners, the Apartheid Party, came in 1948, that had been a stolid, pretty conservative, racist party, mm-hmm. but it pretended to be a little bit more emancipated than the cross racism of the right-wing opposition that it faced. And my parents tended to vote that party in, as a lot of their peers did, you know, election after election, and most of South African small Jewish population tended to vote for them. I reckon the first couple of years of adulthood, I had seen this was absolutely out of the question for me, because they prattled on about racism And when I was just leaving school, there was a breakaway from it led by the very redoubtable liberal Helen Suzman, who was voted in basically by a Jewish vote in a very well-off constituency of Johannesburg. Mm-hmm. And she became the lone voice of this progressive party. Mandela and company really came to appreciate her because she was the lone voice in parliament that raised the issues of the prisoners, mm-hmm. The extremes of apartheid. She would come to the prisons, to Robben Island, to visit them, to see how they were being treated, etc. And that was something that took me up a little bit, and I voted for them in my first election when I could vote, 1962, although I was already a member of the ANC, but this was this one white party that at least was raising a voice of truth. I saw for myself, and I was critical of it, that it couldn't really go far, but it opened things up. And of course, as a white voter, and no blacks were allowed to vote, no mixed race people could vote in terms of the national election, I gave it my vote because I felt this was the best I could do. But I was actually quite critical, and I attended some of their parties, their political party constituencies, and raised my questions from the floor. In the brief period that I was still able to operate in South Africa, I had to leave in 1963 when I went into exile. So this party, we watched its progress over the next 30 years, in fact, and it grew, it managed to garner support amongst the whites. By the time we were reaching the real change in South Africa in 1990, it had some substantial support in the white parliament, and there were some interactions between it and the ANC, but we could see this was a very conservative party for the kind of change that was coming. It incidentally gave birth and rise to the new main opposition in South Africa, the Democratic Alliance, which at last is beginning to attract blacks into its ranks. But South Africa meant, and for me, in that short period of civic involvement and then the long period of resistance, struggle, that there was no way that I would look, as some young radical whites did, for political career in that party or, right. or for voting for it, that for me I could see this was really never going to deliver the goods. It was simply a party of business and of domination by business, which it still is today, although it has about 25% of the vote. The ANC called it a racist party because it was mainly whites, with a lot of the previous apartheid supporters in its ranks. But in the last election, the last 5 years, it's created black leaders, men and women who have come to the fore, quite articulate. It's giving the ANC a run for its money, very critical in parliament and so on. It's taken to the streets recently with other more radical opposition parties to the ANC, but smaller ones, and is making a big noise. But nevertheless, it'll never attract my attention or my support because it basically remains the party of business. Although it's attracting unemployed blacks, working class blacks, but a lot of middle class black people. But essentially, you ask yourself, well, what is it standing for? And it's a voice of business in this country.
So then,
I think, anyway.
That helps us actually get to the next place I wanted to go, to sort of situating, and I think there are lessons here for the United States and the situation we're in terms of late-stage capitalism, a particularly aggressive form of crony capitalism. You did the sort of overview of your experience because you're a contemporary and have experience with these figures like the current president, Jacob Zuma, the former president, Thabo Mbeki. But the narrative that you tell includes, My understanding is that maybe in some ways you and Thabo Mbeki might not have necessarily the same politics, but you thought his treatment was disgraceful and he served as a good president. Obviously, this sort of global admiration for Nelson Mandela. But you've told this narrative that part of the reason that the ANC has sort of gone in this crony capitalist direction is really because of the first bargain with capitalism. The ANC always had several different currents. It was never purely a Marxist organization, but it was a liberation organization. And the emphasis on the collapse of apartheid, not addressing the economic structures which sustained apartheid in the same level as the obvious, you know, just sort of overt forms of discrimination and apartheid structure, that sort of bargain with capitalism led to this ongoing situation of inequality and now what Jacob Zuma is doing with the country. Maybe you could kind of, in the last little bit of time here, speak to that and then explain what exactly Zuma is doing.
Right. Well, I'll try in the short time.
Yeah, no, but take some time, yeah.
Let me say I have tremendous admiration for Mbeki, who's absolutely incorruptible, as Mandela was. Although, by the way, Mandela had quite a liking for the sort of more glamorous life and the kind of celebrities he liked to rub shoulders
with. Like the Spice Girls.
You know, I mean, aspects like that, which some of us really found distasteful. You'll never find that with Mbeki, more of a puritanical person. Mm-hmm. Both of them, of course, eschew personal wealth and corruption and stand up against it. There was a difference between them because Mandela was very outspoken on the HIV issue, and Mbeki, it's regarded that he made certain major errors. But he did that as in terms of a process of people, I would say, a fault in judgment, but nothing in terms of his own power and greed or wealth of that kind. However, we came out of a revolutionary struggle and a revolutionary movement which was inclined to socialism. It was a broad church, but very strong in terms of working class membership and revolutionary ideals, not to create the Red Revolution, but certainly to create a South Africa that, in Mandela's words, would be focused on the poorest of the poor. And if that meant anything, it meant putting into practice the famous Freedom Charter, which was adopted by over 3,000 delegates from all over the country under the noses of the apartheid police in 1955. And that spelt out returning land to those who were the tillers, so a real agrarian reform, the question of nationalization of the heights of the economy, the mines, the banks, the monopoly industries, etc. And it's really when Mandela, 2 years after being released from prison, so we're looking at 1992, kind of moves away from that and is influenced very much by the IMF and the World Bank and the people he's meeting there at Davos in Switzerland. And he basically says, look, we've got to get this political power. And of course he's right. What can you do without getting political power under your control? You can't do anything. He says, on that basis, we must realize we're not going to make this country work and the system work if we start nationalizing, and we'll be isolated internationally and the investments won't come in, and then where will we be? And Mbeki's very much part of it, and to say mea culpa, because the Chris Hineys, the Joe Slovos, the left of the ANC, the Communist Party, we all say, look, let's realize we do have to get this change. We have to get to a national election. We've got to get political power, and then we can start making the change. So I coined the term the Faustian Pact,
right,
not to say that Mandela's the betrayer or Mbeki or an individual, but all of us collectively. We're now within a gross, extreme form of capitalism and racism. And we're taking that option, and we don't realize how we're getting sucked into the system. We're now going with the Washington Consensus and this term, the neoliberal economy, which we basically is about the free capitalist market economy. And once you enter that, you're really caught up in it. And we miss a marvelous opportunity when we're at the heart of revolutionary ascendancy. From then on, things really started taking a dive. And we get more and more engulfed in that. With an Mbeki there, we've got somebody who's a supreme strategist who has an understanding of the world and where South Africa should be placed in it. But it's a very fine line, a tightrope he's walking. And
the paradox, can I just elaborate for just one moment? But it's like the paradox of a guy who on one hand was pushing through, I think the program was GEAR, which was growth redistribution and development. And that was during Mandela. So pushing a very orthodox neoliberal line, and then at the same time also giving lectures and speeches where he would talk about the globalization of apartheid and recognizing that the economic conditions that the West and the Western corporate sector was pushing on the rest of the world was a system that has, I mean, very overtly exploded in everybody's face over the last several years, but even back then was an engine of immense inequality.
Exactly. You're absolutely on the point there. Just to say that outside of the actual economic diktat, etc., what is also happening is a tendency not to keep the fires alive amongst the masses, amongst the people, amongst your followers. And then a hegemony creeps in which those who are the crony capitalists, those who simply want to benefit for themselves, they take over. This is then the ascendancy of the Jacob Zumas and the patronage system that goes with it, that gets worse and worse. And the political consciousness then is so acutely and badly affected that you get a demobilization of your constituency. And these are the guys that begin to rule the roost. And that's basically the kind of corruption and patronage system that we've entered into in South Africa. I said Mbeki's trying. He's got this worldview. He has an understanding for sure. He's got a Marxist brain, but he's trying to take us along a precipice, or I once said it was walking the tightrope, and he could perhaps do it, but when he's not there, you then have somebody like Jacob Zuma, who's already corrupt. He's been involved in corruption. His financial advisor has been sentenced, and he was connected with it. He was lucky he wasn't charged. He gets away with all of that, and there's then the green light for the corruption that is taking place.
Right.
So we get into that. What we don't have on the American side is the imperialist nature of South Africa.
Right.
And the military aggression, which is what you now face, but you face it from whatever party, Republican or Democrat.
Right.
So that aspect we don't have, but we obviously part of the whole global process, and we're very worried, those of us who are aware to what's happening in terms of a possible being on the possible eve of a war, what's happening in North Korea, in Syria, the attacks there, where there was absolutely no proof whatsoever that Assad had used poison gas on his own people, blah, blah, blah. So, you know, there is that difference between South Africa and your country and, of course, the European Union and Britain.
Do you think, as a final question, and I will just note, maybe this is for another conversation, I know some people, because I do think Assad, I didn't support the strikes, but I do think Assad was the person who delivered those attacks. But there will be many members of the audience who are going to gleefully report that I was schooled by you, which is great. But anyways, do you think as, I don't know how to articulate this, but the final question I would have is, you're talking about civil society movements in South Africa. We know in the United States that in order to not just deal with Trump, but the kind of larger structures that you're talking about in terms of the kind of imperial nature of the system and the underlying problems. It's definitely, it might be delivered through aspects of the Democratic Party on some domestic issues, but certainly overall not internationally in terms of how we conduct ourselves in the world and whose interests we're acting on behalf. It seems like we've had some social emancipation over the past couple of decades, but this market system, which is eating everything away, is this sort of, that's the variable that just doesn't seem to be able to really be moved. And so is it, you know, I guess, where do you find the ripest sources of resistance or hope in the current environment, or do you?
Well, you know what I want to say?
Yeah.
That you living in the citadel of imperialism, of aggression, of capitalism, you're the world power. That's daunting.
Yeah.
On the other hand, and you're asking me about where do we, people like myself, find some source of inspiration in our country, I want to just turn that, if you don't mind, to you, to your listeners, to your people. I think it's absolutely magnificent how we see time and time again, and I mentioned, start with the civil rights movement, which was glorious, and where you began to unite black and white in the United States. But what we've seen in the streets of America in terms of the Occupy movement, yeah, the anti-war movement, the anti-race issues, the coming together of support, Black Lives Matter, the incredible inspiration which your civil movement of the states need to realize. And I know sometimes when it's so dark and when you're faced, yeah, with such incredible militarism and a police state almost, where you don't realize the extent to which your protests actually fire and inspire those of us throughout the world. And from that point of view, I think the aspects of the civil society in the states on so many planes that is leading a struggle, a fight back, and this is affecting all of us throughout the world. Of course, one's got to find the motive forces for this in one's own society. And in South Africa, where we've had, you've got this two-party state or dictatorship, I'll put that in quotes, as Marx would really call bourgeois democracy, right, of this extreme kind. And we've had the emergence of something I was so happy with. Every time, every election, we managed to pump up the ANC's vote. From the first election under Mandela, it was 62. Under Mbeki, in terms of our fourth election, we got to almost 70%. It immediately started sliding back under Zuma. Right. It went down to 52% in national local elections in 2016. And our people were demobilized. And a few of us started raising our voices, and small groups did. And then the trade union began splitting in some sections because they were so supporting Zuma and had supported him against Mbeki, realized that they had got things wrong, right, and we got the labor movement, middle class elements, young people, students, youth, unemployed women, gender issues, because Zuma and his group, right, are just so dreadful in relation to gender factors. So we are seeing building up right now as we speak huge marches on Zuma, on our government, on our parliament. We had something they say like about 200,000 in the streets just a week ago. And this is, you know, this is in a country that's, what, a tenth of the population, right, of the states.
So so the lesson is
very, very big.
Yeah. So the lesson, I guess, is in everywhere in the United States and South Africa, stay on the streets and look to where there's light. Ronnie Casserolls, as I always say, it really is an honor
to
have you on.
Okay, the one thing to say is from the streets, we've got to build organization.
Right.
You see, we can't just do,
right,
it on the streets.
Right.
We've got to build a revolutionary organization.
Right, right.
Thanks very much, Mike.
Right. Ronnie Casserolls, I appreciate your time immensely. I hope we can do it again sometime soon.
Thank you. Very grateful. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Okay.
There it is. A lot of good little nuggets in that interview, I think. Revolutionary structure, and also talking about positively about both the relevance of street movements in America to global inspiration. I mean, hearing that the ANC was inspired by the 60s movements here in America is pretty interesting. And also as the vote totals as a register of their mobilization. So I think these things aren't really contradictory as sometimes people like to think. But hey, Matt and Jamie, how's it going?
Hey. Wow.
Matt is in space, I think.
Going good. Matt is clearly coming at us from a crypt to celebrate the start of spooky season.
And we can't hear his microphone either, so off to a great start here.
It's hard to get Wi-Fi in the crypt.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, so let's see if... the problem with Binder has to route the audio for the phones and everything, so I think this might be probably an audio hijack issue. Not exactly seeing him. I guess before, while he tries to figure that out, I want to talk about Donald Trump being in Minnesota. And I take a lot of pride. I'm not from Minnesota. I'm a North Dakotan, but often, North Dakotans like me look east and think of themselves as Minnesotans, especially when you're more liberal minded and urban oriented. But anyway, there's a lot of troubles, particularly with red Minnesota and the Conservative Party. And Donald Trump went up to address some of those red Minnesotans in Duluth, and here's what he had to say.
That you got to change it. Who's going to do what we've done for you? Right? Another massive issue for Minnesota is the election of Joe Biden's plan to inundate your state with a historic flood of refugees. Biden and crazy Bernie Sanders have agreed on a manifesto. Did you see last night? I didn't agree after the show. They said, oh, actually he did. Oh, great. They fact checked. They found out he made a mistake, slight mistake. It's the worst thing you've ever seen. But they pledged a 700% increase in refugees. 700%! Congratulations, Minnesota! Congratulations. Now, and what about Omar, where she gets caught harvesting? What the hell is going on? I hope your U.S. attorney is involved. What is going on with Omar? I've been reading these reports for 2 years about how corrupt and crooked she is. Let's get with it. Let's get with it.
All right, that's good.
I mean, frankly, harvesting.
So, to be clear, this is a Project Veritas smear of Ilhan Keith Ellison and the Somali community in Minnesota. And it goes back, we posted the clip from New York Times of poll watchers accusing specific communities, mainly like non-white and poor, of cheating at the ballot box. This is just exactly what that is. The allegations against Ilhan are particularly spurious, tied to this guy named Omar Jamel, who started something called the Somali Watchdog Group a month ago that was registered. He's known as basically telling journalists exactly what they want to hear about radical Muslims. He was in the Obama administration. He's talking about Al-Qaeda infiltration of that Somali community a few years ago, or maybe it was just a year ago, talking about Ilhan being anti-Semitic. So Omar Jamel, I think he's a black guy, basically. So I think, the identity politics representational, he weaponizes that. And this is very dangerous because I want to play now the way the right wing is responding to this. This is Josh Bernstein. Hey, Matt, are you there?
I am there. Do you hear
nice.
Me?
Nice. Yes, we can.
Beautiful. Right.
Awesome. So this is Josh Bernstein. I don't know who Josh Bernstein is, but I think what he says here, despite some of the language used, is exactly in line with the Minnesota GOP and most of the other GOP's response to this party. Now, they wouldn't use some of the language he says here, but play this clip, and I'd like every Republican to delineate where they disagree here.
I believe that the FBI and the Department of Justice should charge Ilhan Noor Sayed Elmi with sedition, treason, marriage fraud, voter fraud, illegal campaign contributions, immigration fraud, and aiding and abetting our enemies. She is a worthless pile of shit. Okay? Let me be as clear as I can, Right Wing Watch. All right? She should be arrested, tried, and I know your favorite word, Right Wing Watch. What's your favorite word? How many articles have you written about me when I've used this word? The E word? That's right. This bitch should be executed. There it is. I said it once again.
Now, I don't think most Republicans want her executed, but a lot of that is basically the attitude that they're conveying about her. Every single one of the statements from official Republicans in that state has been to bolster James O'Keefe's claims. That's the kid's name, right? From Project Veritas?
Yes.
It sounds like a school shooter's name, to be honest, which is why I paused for a second there. And something else happened with regards to, I want to just draw, I'm sorry this has been indulgent in the upper Midwest, but something else happened with regards to the Minnesota GOP being what I would call, neo-Nazi, crypto-Nazi, is so last night there was a debate, Senator Roger Chamberlain basically was asked about, I don't know, have you heard of the Bronze Age Manifesto, either of you? Mm-hmm. So yeah. can you characterize that for us? Basically, I don't know much about it.
Matt B might know more than me. I just know that it's some like alt-right white civilization, great replacement nonsense.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, that's really all you really need to know about it.
Okay. So, Roger Chamberlain was asked about, his promotion of this. And here's this exchange.
Earlier this summer, a publication, the Minnesota Reformer, called into question some of your Twitter activity, mm-hmm. Saying that you sent a tweet to and have liked several tweets, I believe, mm-hmm. By someone reported to be mm-hmm. someone who talks a lot about in a mm-hmm. book and mm-hmm. on a podcast mm-hmm. about white supremacist mm-hmm. ideas. Mm-hmm. And your opponent and other DFL party in the state made a little bit of hay with that. Do you have any kind of response for that?
Two things is, first, it's libel, it's slander. They took the post down.
They haven't.
Both on Twitter and Facebook.
Earlier this summer.
Okay, so let's go to the evidence, which the Minnesota Democratic Party helpfully pointed out here. Just a few screenshots of Roger Chamberlain retweeting, you know, the book, A Bronze Age Mindset by Bronze Age Pervert. Look at that. I mean, Jesus. Like, I don't know. So it's not libel. It has not been retracted. He's a liar. He is a lying like a fascist lies. And that's what their Minnesota Republican Party is. And it is super dangerous what they have been doing to Ilhan the entire time. And she needs more support from her party. And also the Minnesota police point out they're looking into voter fraud allegations after the Project Veritas scoop. I hope that they're taking death threats against Ilhan as seriously. And if any threat is at the hands of the official Republican Party of Minnesota. This is not Trump. This is not anything else. This is a festering mess in the Minnesota Republican Party. And it terrifies me all the time because I know people who work for Ilhan. Like it's terrifying. There's a lot of guns in northern Minnesota.
Right. Matt has been ballot harvesting with people that he knows in Minnesota.
Donald Trump's vote is harvested. His Florida right. vote is harvested.
No, it really goes to show you just how wrong-headed all those, and I don't want to say leftists, but left-leaning people, a lot of mainstream Democrats were, when they were jumping on the anti-Ilhan Omar train, right when Donald Trump and other sort of right-wing groups were attacking her for really ridiculous reasons, for a tweet where she called out how corporate lobbyists affect how politicians act and how they vote. And they basically turned it into some sort of anti-Semitic attack that she was perpetrating, which was absolutely 100% not true. Mm-hmm. And people on Democrats and people left leaning fell for it. And they jumped on board the train to attack her and demonize her. And they forced some sort of apology out of her. And they still haven't really walked back what they did to her. While, you know, while white supremacists were sending her death threats, she also had to deal with people who ostensibly are on her side are, you know, poo-pooing a tweet that she did. It was ridiculous.
Yeah. People need to understand the context here. There was also Dan Crenshaw saying that she was downplaying 9/11 when the specific point she was making is that people projected Islamic terrorism on every Muslim. Like, that's the type of dishonesty. And that's not dishonesty about anything. That's dishonesty about terrorism. Okay, we killed hundreds of thousands of people over that, right? That is incitement to violence. And that's what the official Republican policy is towards Ilhan Omar.
Yeah, and hate crimes went up, as we all know, in the Bush years, in the 9/11 era, at a time when Muslims were being demonized. And she experienced racist abuse when she was a child in school. So the fact that this is still happening is not surprising, but it is very concerning that it seems to be on an upswing. Also, like, okay, I have been ambivalent, and I'm still ambivalent about the idea of an armed left. But when I hear shit like this, it makes me think that she should have an armed bodyguard at all times, because there are people who want to do her harm. And the Republicans, the people that she has to sit across the aisle from in her own state, they are whipping up this racist hatred. And it's scary.
I mean, Donald Trump literally just said stand by to a documentedly violent hate group.
Right. Yeah. Right. On top of that, actually, I was just looking at a story the other day. I can't remember which Democratic House member it was, but one of the House members who is in the Democratic Party has been receiving tons of death threats, and he's a middle-aged white guy. So obviously, it's not as bad as how Ilhan Omar receives. But here we have a white guy receiving death threats because this is where it gets analogous to what we were just talking about. The National Republican, the National Republican Campaign Committee, Congressional Committee, excuse me, has put out ads attacking him using QAnon language right after he signed on to a bipartisan bill to basically get Congress to officially denounce QAnon. And now he's receiving tons of death threats because the QAnon conspiracy theorists think that he's a pedophile, and the National Republican Congressional Committee has signed on to this with ads basically promoting that very same ideological belief that these guys have. I mean, this is the Republican Party. It's not just some sort of fringe group. Even if the mainstream doesn't actually believe it, they full on take advantage of the fringe groups and use it for their own attacks.
100%. I mean, I'm fairly certain, and I haven't been following the QAnon stuff super closely, but I'm fairly certain I've heard of even prior candidates dropping out for similar attention. Like, just, I can't handle this. Like, QAnon is becoming basically a mass digital connected brown shirt movement to harass local candidates. Like, right. That's right. I mean, that's what it's being activated now as. And 100%. And by the way, let's bring up somebody else who piled onto the Ilhan stuff by promoting Project Veritas. Tulsi Gabbard, who has been synchronized with fascist talking points since she used to troll Obama for not saying radical Islamic terrorism. And most recently, she joined the QDs, pile on.
And that makes her my biggest enemy, actually.
It shouldn't be surprising, I guess, right?
Always been a wing nut, and she's always aligned herself with ethno-nationalists. So yeah. It's really, the situation in the U.S. right now is somewhat analogous to the situation in India, right? Where an ethnic majority decides to do an ethno-nationalism and oppress minorities. And, she probably feels very familiar with it.
Brendan, yeah. Could you bring up that picture I just put in I dropped in the IM of Tulsi Gabbard's recent Instagram stories?
And then,
oh yeah, we had this morning.
And then a certain type of person who usually denigrates.
Oh, you showed it in the beginning. Oh, okay. Right. Yeah. I mean,
yeah,
this is who she backs up, Dan Crenshaw. I mean, this is completely like unsurprising, but still it tells you exactly who she is.
And a certain type of person who denigrates any what they perceive an expression of identity politics rushes to Tulsi's defense when you say, hey, maybe this like Hindutva and Modi stuff, maybe we should interrogate that a little bit as to where your political allegiances lie. That's actually offensive to do. I mean, I think Tulsi's a snake, as like every bit as much as the Tulsi people like to say Elizabeth Warren was, and Elizabeth Warren also was, but Tulsi is too. And the people that didn't see it and that chose to overlook, like I don't know how people overlook the radical Islamic terror thing, unless you're just bigoted against Muslims as well. But
I mean, my take on her, not to get too into this on the first half of the show, but my take on her was always, listen, if she wants to endorse the leftist candidate and support them and bring whatever weirdos who support her along for the ride, let them that they could be an ally in that way, but in no way should you bring them into the larger discourse discussion. No way should you become a supporter of hers and get on board the Tulsi Gabbard Express or whatever. I mean, you know, it is what it is during a primary, but at the same time, you need to understand who these people are at their core, and not just, you know, just because they endorse someone you also like doesn't mean they're all of a sudden are a staunch leftist.
And yeah. And I'll say a lot of people are buying into the mythology around like the courage it took her to endorse Bernie Sanders. And I would just say, I don't think any of us maybe know everything that went on with her and the DNC. So like, right. I think it's a little bit embarrassing the way people always point to that. Like, she took a huge risk.
Right.
Pretty obvious reward there.
No, I completely agree. Yeah. But also let's talk about more recently. I mean, it was really courageous actually for her in 2020 to keep her completely dead and never getting off the ground campaign going when it just came down to Bernie Sanders and Joe Biden realistically. And then also drop out while Bernie finally, after the major races, and Bernie probably didn't have a shot at that point, but he was still in the race, and she drops out and finally endorses Joe Biden. Very courageous of her.
Yeah. So
that news clip of Chamberlain too reminds me of that meme that's going around where there's like an Antifa guy, and you know, the crying face guy is like, oh, you're far right communist, aren't you? And the Antifa guy's like, yeah, or far left, excuse me. The Antifa guy's like, yeah. And then there's a right wing guy, and they're like, oh, you're a far right fascist. And he's like, no, I'm not. I was only posting it as a joke. It was irony, whatever, right. Whatever. Like, these people will never admit to what they are because it comes off pretty badly.
Because it's a popular liability. Whereas, like, I would agree. Like, for instance, if someone said, hey, you were promoting, like, France Fanon, like, that it talks about, like, violence and that stuff. And, you know what? I think people need to contextualize maybe the Algerian Revolution and listen to Fanon, and there's a lot of insight there. I wouldn't run away and say, actually, it's libelous. I've never read Fanon. And, like, right? Like, it's just obvious. And that's, it's for exactly the reason you said. They cannot elaborate their true beliefs. That's what that's what the intellectual dark web is truly about. Because if there's enough light in there, you can actually see what's going on, and things start to be defined a little bit easier.
Right.
Maybe we should get to the fun half now, guys.
I feel like our conversations are going to more fun half type content.
Yeah. Who wants to start our promotion little moment?
I did last week, so why don't you guys take it away for now?
All right, Jamie.
Well, I'll keep it short and sweet. Speaking of QAnon, we have a new two-part History is a Weapon on QAnon. We got Sean KB. We got Matt Chrisman. They're talking the political economy of conspiracy theories and what the hell is up with QAnon. First part came out yesterday. Second part is out tomorrow. Patreon.com/TheAntifada. Also, I was on our friend of the show, Pod Damn America, this week to talk about the debate, the elefonky, and other important topics of the day. So you can find that. Just type in Pod Damn America and it'll come up.
Yeah, on TMBS on Tuesday, we had a members-only pregame show where we had Gene Bajalan on to talk about Armenian-Azerbaijan conflict and the Turkish role and also the great powers and what's going on there. And then we covered the debate. Yeah, and tonight I think I'm going live. I think depends. Sometimes it's just kind of how I feel. I'm sorry, but I think I'm going to go live at twitch.tv/literary hangover. Might follow some Canadian fur trading routes in Flight Simulator. So yeah, that's twitch.tv/literary hangover.
Cool. So tonight at youtube.com/MattBinder at 9:30 p.m. Eastern time, I'll be talking to David Bixenspan, and we will be getting into how QAnon is seeping into the real world and our example of the real world that we'll really dive into. And it's analogous to many other areas of our everyday life. Pro wrestling. We'll be talking about how QAnon has become a thing for certain pro wrestlers to rally around. And in that conversation, we'll actually be talking about a little bit broadly about this group that has been trying to use their legitimate charity that's been trying to use QAnon to promote their own stuff. And basically, they've been like covering, you know, child sex trafficking since way before QAnon, but they're In the face of all these other legitimate groups saying that QAnon does not help them get these issues to the forefront, these guys are trying to use it and say, no, QAnon does help us, because they're trying to, you know, it's a grift, basically. So we'll be talking about that tonight. And if you're looking for something to do before tonight, I was on the Nomiki show yesterday to talk about the debate. You could check that out. And I also had my own debate coverage at youtube.com/MattBinder.
All right, folks, we would be playing the Danarchy video. I don't know why I'm saying this, but we might be getting demonetized for it, so we're going to go to the good old...
Why would you get demonetized for it?
I don't know.
It's a suspicion that Sam has.
Yeah.
So we're going to honor it.
So we're going to test the... we're going to go back to the good old and also dense with amazing amounts of detail MR Fun video, and we'll see you in the fun.
Fun half!
Left is best.
Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous, you're a little bit upset, you're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude. You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Some good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2, 5/8, 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd,
don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance. My first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jab.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good. Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
This, that guy might be a Nazi.
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Ooh.
Wow.
But
Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. Let's I want to just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me,
hey, shut up.
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.